This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From the Trackout Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hi, everybody. I'm Jeremy Scott. Great to have you along for the ride. Got a packed show for you today. A colleague of mine who I've known for a while, was able to watch his work growing up. Now he is head of the Team USA Scholarship, actually has been since its inception 30 years ago. We've got three new winners. Normally there's one, sometimes two, but this year, because of everything going on, got three of them. And one of them's going to have a special deal to go along with the other two. Jeremy Shaw, Team USA Scholarship, will be joining us here momentarily. Then I've got together the best roundtable that we can think of to talk about the best post-war drivers who've never won the Indy 500. We've got Paul Dalby from Field of 33, Nick Yeoman, our IndyCar insider from the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network, and also have our driver analyst, Charlie Ante. We're going to talk about this article that was posted by Paul Tracy last week on article from AutoWeek in May, around the time when the Indy 500 was supposed to run. It lists, and we find out a revelation how it's listed, the top 10 drivers to never win the Indy 500, and then we'll talk about ours. But in between then, our F4 FR America's insider, Eric Brennan from FanRacing.live, will join us talking about the Florida stretch that will happen within the two series. They've got back-to-back weekends in Florida this weekend at Sebring International Raceway, the next weekend at the Homestead Miami Speedway. So, as always, you can reach us at Inside Open Wheel on Twitter, Inside Open Wheel on Facebook, or InsideOpenWheel@gmail.com. That's the email. Also, if you are willing to leave a voicemail for us, you can always call us at 815-714-9260. With that information. So some big news came out on Tuesday, the time of the release. Sage Karam will be running the Harvest Grand Prix in a couple of weeks at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. He has a sponsor with the Dryden Rheinbold team, so add two more races to the young Pennsylvania driver on his schedule. I have a feeling that we might be seeing more of Sage next season. I'd like to see more of JR, but I have a feeling he's turned into an Indy 500 driver only. It kind of does suck, but great to see Oil to Soil come up through the ranks and sponsor the car fully. The car looks great, and some of the fans have said that it looks like a Braun GP from about 10 years ago. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. Sebastian Bourdais, as we said, is going to run the full weekend. Also, Scott McLaughlin, we'll talk more about this later on the show. He's going to come over and run the Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg. I'm really excited about that. Remember his interview earlier on. We'll play snippets of that as we get closer to the Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg. Coming up next, Team USA Scholarships' Jeremy Shaw talks with us about the scholarship and the winners for this season. The wait is over. Inside Open Wheel is now on Apple Podcasts. So no matter where you get your favorite podcast from, you can always get a new episode of Inside Open Wheel on that same program. Heck, you can even get a push notification right when we release new episodes. Once again, Inside Open Wheel, we're now on Apple Podcasts.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, 30 years ago, some of your favorite racers didn't really have a way to promote themselves a little bit better, to kind of make themselves more worldwide known. Then names like Vasser, Herta, Ave, and Borkowski ended up winning a scholarship to go race overseas, whether it be in England or in New Zealand. This year, we have three winners of the Team USA Scholarship. It is a very prestigious honor to win the scholarship. Joining me is Jeremy Shaw from the Team USA Scholarship. Jeremy, we've talked about this, it had to have been at least a decade ago, and a lot has changed. We've had more winners throughout. Thanks for taking the time to talk about this year's winners and really the scholarship in general.
Absolutely, my pleasure. You know, it's been a fun program for me. It's been a long ride, but an enjoyable ride, and it's really satisfying to be able to keep it going for such a long time, I must admit. Thank you.
And I know it's a little difficult this year because you would take drivers, I believe it was to Mid-Ohio IndyCar Weekend, I remember it at Mid-Ohio, interview them, and then a little bit after we'd find out who the scholarship winner is. But obviously in the age of COVID-19, it's kind of difficult with a lot of these paddocks restricting access, travel restrictions. So talk about the process this year and how it was different from years past.
Yeah, you're right. You know, in the past, I generally kind of identify a group of candidates, and then the first step of the process really is to invite them all into one setting and invite them to generally We met, as you say, over the IndyCar weekend at Mid-Ohio, and it was an opportunity there for all the youngsters to meet a lot of people that were involved in the industry, get involved kind of behind the scenes a bit. The teams, pretty much all the IndyCar teams have been, I've known them all for a long time, and they're all sort of super supportive of this program. So they kind of allow one or more of the kids, each of the kids, to be kind of embedded with their IndyCar teams over the weekend and or one of the Road to Indy teams as well. So it's really good insight for the youngsters into really how the sport works. Well, as you say, this year, very, very different. And yeah, it's been pretty horrible for everybody. I mean, I haven't traveled anywhere since March, which is bizarre for me after so many years on the road. So this time, and I wasn't even sure whether it was going to be possible to carry on with the program, because I really didn't feel that it was the right time or place to go up beyond asking our regular supporters to cough up money for these youngsters when, you know, there's so much uncertainty in the world. Well, finally, you know, the racing season got going several months late. It became apparent that the regular events that we take the kids to in the UK were going to go ahead. So I thought, okay, well, I might as well put out some feelers. So I did, and the overwhelming response from all of our supporters was, hell yes, let's get this thing on the road. So it was a pretty short process. I identified just a half a dozen candidates this year, and I got them each to provide a couple of videos explaining a little bit about themselves and a short writing assignment as well. Generally speaking, we do the interviews at the racetrack, and then I kind of, with input from a whole bunch of different people that were involved in the interviews themselves, team owners, you know, officials, whatever it might be, we'd whittle it down to half a dozen finalists who would take part in a shootout. And for the last 3 or 4 years, that's been held in conjunction with the Lucas Oil School of Racing, which has been a tremendous program. Well, none of that could happen this year, so it was just short-circuited the whole thing. I shared the videos and writing assignments with a couple of dozen different people from within the industry, and then we made our decisions from there.
And let's talk about the nominees. We're going to go with the ones who, there were three winners this year, but three who were nominated. Eli Navarro, he runs in the Lucas Oil Formula Race Car Series. So at that point, you know, if there would have been a shootout, it almost would have been like, well, you know, kind of unfair because he's still running the series. But regardless, he has 2 wins, 5 podiums this year. Max Easterson, 5th in the F1600 Championship Series from Watermill, New York. He turned on 1 win and 3 podiums. And Bryce Aaron, also racing in 1600s, but he's racing in England. 1 win, 10 podiums from Winnetka, Illinois. Right now, off the bat, we're seeing 3 cars that basically run, in essence, wingless formula cars. So the 3 winners, they've already, you know, they're going to have a good shot at what the prize is.
Yes, I think so. And really, one of the keys to making the final selection of this program has always been who is ready to take advantage of the opportunity. That's a big thing for me. It's, you know, for anybody looking to make a career in this sport, you've got to look at the big picture. You know, am I ready to move on to the next level? Because you're really only going to get one shot at this for most people. Racing is expensive, as we all know. So you can't afford to go wasting money. You need to spend your money wisely. And therefore, one of my big hot buttons, if you like, is, you know, are you ready to take advantage of this opportunity, whatever that may be? In this case, it's a Team USA scholarship. And it's interesting. I think I had a couple of dozen people get back to me on, you know, having shared the candidates' information. And it was pretty much unanimous, you know, which 3 drivers would be the, you know, best prepared to take advantage of the opportunity right now. You talked about the fact that Eli perhaps might have had an advantage if we'd had a shootout as usual. But, you know, I've been doing this a long, long time, and all the people who helped me out with the judging, you know, it's the same sort of group of people over the years. So yeah, we look past things like that. That's really not a factor at all. But you know, we figured that Eli, Max, and Dylan, you know, all good guys. That's why they're nominated for this thing. And you know, they got to look at the bigger picture and realize, you know, perhaps that they're not quite ready to take advantage of this opportunity. I think all of them are going to mature a lot more. This is, for each of them, it's their first season of racing cars. So, you know, they've got to realize there's a hell of a lot to learn in this business. And to throw them in the deep end in the Formula Ford events we do in the UK, you know, they're going to be up against people there who have been doing this for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And there's more, there's some of them have been doing it for longer than that. So, you know, there is no substitute for experience in this sport. And therefore, yeah, I try to pick the three guys that are kind of best prepared to take advantage of it, like I say.
And I do want to correct myself. I overlooked Dylan Christie. I do want to apologize. Actually, Dylan will be with us next week. He had a prior commitment that I had technical issues with power again. But he had a prior commitment that he had to go. He's actually testing a USF 2000 car at time of recording. So we're to talk to him about that later on. But yeah, Bryce Aaron, Jackson Lee, Simon Sykes, your winners. Bryce running in the 1600, Formula Ford 1600 cars. As you remember, Jackson Lee was on last week on Inside Open Wheel. He's currently second in the S1600 Championship, 2 wins and 5 podiums. They're going to go over for the Walter Hayes Trophy. And that's going to be interesting because you're still using Cliff Dempsey for your cars, correct?
Yeah, it's now Low Dempsey Racing. Okay. Cliff and Michelle Dempsey had run the team for many, many years. Cliff himself was a former racer. You'll be familiar with their son, Peter.
Yep.
Who runs Turn 3 Motorsport over here. He was a successful driver in his own right, Peter was, and you know, is now following his father's footsteps by running his own team. But the Cliff and Michelle, like most of us, are not getting any younger. They're looking to the future. And in Andy Lowe, who's been working with that team for the last few years, Andy wanted to kind of step up to the plate and you become a team owner. So it was a perfect combination. So pretty much everything is the same about the team, just the name is slightly different.
Okay, so yeah, Peter's doing quite well for himself right now, running well in Radical Cup, also doing some Indy Pro 2000, as we saw with Daniel Frost, podiuming at Mid-Ohio. But Simon Sykes is the other winner. He will not be able to participate in the Walter Hayes Trophy. Instead, he's going to get a test in a Lamborghini Super Trofeo.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, Simon, he's been on the radar screen now for several years actually, but he's one of those guys that, you know, he wasn't able to put together a full season of racing in anything. So even though he's been on the radar screen, he hasn't really been, as I say, ready to take advantage of this sort of opportunity in the past. Well, this year he put a great effort in. He put a full season program together to run in the F1600 Championship Series with Greg Rice's Rice Race Prep team, and you know, he's leading that championship. He's been the guy to beat as a result primarily of his experience and the fact that he is pretty darn good. So he was always on the radar screen. Well, I'm happy to say that Simon has already been invited by Will Marotti to join the Legacy Autosport team and take part in several of the last few races of the season in the Coupetage USF 2000 Championship. So that's the first step on the road to Indy. And so one of those events at St. Petersburg clashes with the UK trip. So he really wasn't able to go over there and commit to doing the three events that our guys will be doing in the UK. But I still wanted to include him in the program because, you know, I just like to reward the fact that he's worked super hard to get where he is right now. He's kind of financed some of his own racing by developing and marketing a chest protector for go-kart drivers, which I think is really cool. He's a really smart young man. He's made this opportunity for himself. And, you know, anything I can do to help kind of, you know, bring his career along a little bit more, meet him, introduce him to some more people. He, like the other two, will all get a chance to drive his Lamborghini Super Trofeo car later in the year, or perhaps early next year. Lamborghini has been super helpful in putting that program, that opportunity together. Our guys did it last year, so this will be the second year of that. And again, it'll just sort of kind of, you know, broaden the envelope for Simon and give him an introduction to something a little bit different.
And I've got to say, I've interviewed both Simon and Jackson, and both of them well-polished as individuals, and that you need to go far here too.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, that's all a part of being able to create a career for yourself in this sport. If you haven't got the mental acuity, if you don't have the personality to add to your racing skills, then your chances of making it anywhere are pretty slim. So, you know, they have to be as well-rounded as possible, both in and out of the race car. It's super important.
Jeremy Shaw, Team USA Scholarship, joins us here on Inside Open Wheel. Let's talk a little bit about the history of Team USA Scholarship. You know, we see some of the names that have come through here. Two-time defending IndyCar champion Joseph Newgarden has been a part of it. Spencer Pigot, who, you know, I've watched him come up through the ranks, and he's been really quick. J.R. Hildebrand, Buddy Rice, Andy Lally. It's basically the who's who of motorsports that have come through the program.
Yeah, you know, it's we've been doing this a long time, so you know, it's as long as the drivers are able to go on and make a career for themselves, and it really is kind of self-promoting. It's been really cool to see. But you know, it's funny, I mean, I'm obviously not from around these parts originally. I'm originally from the UK, but came over here in the middle 80s, and about it was in 1990. In the UK, there were so many new open wheel series starting up. There was Formula Ford had been the staple since the late 60s, but by the late 80s and early late 80s, there was things like there was Formula Renault, there was Formula Vauxhall Lotus, there was all sorts of other sort of one make series coming in there and kind of diluting the talent pool, if you like, all sorts of different options for people to go. So at that stage, Formula Ford was struggling. And the Formula Ford Festival had been run at the end of every year since 1972, I think, was the first one. And it's just a fantastic event. It always used to draw drivers from not only around the country, or not even around just from Europe, but from literally around the world as well. You know, Mark Webber did it, and you know, a whole bunch of other people over the years have come to the UK to race in the Formula Ford Festival. And with Formula Ford going through some pretty slim times, they were actually cancelling British Formula Ford Championship races that year through lack of entries. And I thought, if this is going to be the last ever Formula Ford Festival, number one, I want to go there because it was always one of my favourite events of the year in the UK. And I hadn't been at that stage since I left in 85, so I hadn't been to one for 5 years. I thought, right, I've got to go. Number one, I've got to go myself just to be there in case it is the last one. And then second, I thought, well, wait a minute, wouldn't it be fun to take a young American over there and see if we can do fairly well? If Formula Ford is struggling, there aren't that many entries, maybe we can put together a little program, take someone over there, and yeah, they've got a better chance of doing well if there aren't so many cars. Well, to cut a long story short, everybody had the same idea. And that year, it was one of the largest entries they'd ever had. It was well over 200 cars turned up for the Formula Ford Festival. That didn't quite work out as I'd anticipated, which is great news because the festival now, 30 years later, is still going strong. Don't have quite that many entries nowadays, but it's certainly super competitive as it ever was. But having had a word around, I was involved then in the IndyCar series, as a commentator like you, and as I spoke around to various people, they said, yeah, we'd like to chip in and help with that. So all of a sudden, we came together. We put the deal together with Jimmy Vassar. We went over there and ran. It was a one-off car run by some friends of mine who were just super good guys, and it was a nice little car, but it was certainly underprepared. It was a new car, and it just really wasn't quite ready for that level, and nor were we ready for the level of competition either. So it was a bit of a tough time. But you go speak to Jimmy Vassar now, and the whole experience was absolutely fantastic. He loved the experience. Results weren't there, but he met a lot of people. While he was over in the UK, I think we went to Reynard's and Lola's, and you know, introduced himself to some people in the racing industry that he hadn't otherwise had an opportunity to meet. And the same, you know, it just kind of expanded from there over the next few years. And you know, both Jimmy and Brian Herter, who was the winner in 1991, you know, they have nothing but good things to say about the program and about the opportunities it presented to them to go to meet some different people. So you know, it's been a fun program over the years. It's just kind of, you know, grown steadily since then. You know, people say, well, you know, it's still a relatively low level in the sport, But I think that's one of its successes. I haven't tried to overstep the mark. We've just sort of kind of kept it to where it was, you know, to have a little successful niche. But it, you know, you look at the drivers come through it, and it's clearly, you know, the program works. So why change it?
You know, we've seen drivers who've won Indy 500s, Rolex 24s, Le Mans, Champ Car, IndyCar Championships, gone on and been successful in almost every form of racing that have come through there. So it does work. And did you ever imagine that it would be to the level that it is today, you know, 30 years later now, still running it, and an extensive list of drivers who've not only won it, but have come through the program and have still done well?
Yeah, that's a cool thing. I mean, there's very few people who've come through the program who haven't gone on to make a career for themselves. It's probably maybe a handful, which over 30 years is pretty remarkable. But I think it just goes to show that, you know, I mean, it's not just me, obviously. There's a lot of people who make this program possible. I don't make the decision on my own as to which drivers we take. I always, yeah, I mean, inclusive for that in involving as many people in the industry as I can. And so, you know, everybody gets an opportunity to meet these kids, and they can see that, you know, the talent is there. They have the other attributes that are going to be necessary to make a career out of the sport. And so that's why it has been so successful, I think, over the years. It's certainly very satisfying, and it's been super cool to see it. And, you know, what's also interesting is, you know, so many of the former scholarship winners have come back to contribute to the program, you know, once they become proper professionals themselves. And I think that speaks volumes for the quality of the characters that we pick as well, which is, again, super important.
Jeremy Shaw, Team USA Scholarship. First off, I've got to ask, how can the fans at home follow the Walter Hayes Trophy with our Team USA Scholarship winners?
Yeah, there'll be the first event they're going to do is they're going to do the final round of the British Championship, which the British Formula Ford Championship, which is at Silverstone on the international circuit. So they'll be using the F1 wing as a pit lane, which is kind of cool. They'll be going to be doing that on October the 10th, I think it's a Saturday race meeting. And then 2 weeks later, they'll be at the Formula Ford Festival, which is at Brands Hatch. And then the weekend after that is the Walter Hayes Trophy at Silverstone. All of those events will be covered on, I think there's probably going to be a live stream thing at the time, which I shall put out on social media at Team USA Schol, S-C-H-O-L is what we use for Twitter and Facebook and sometimes Instagram, if I can get my head around it, but I still haven't figured out Instagram, to be honest. They'll all be on. There's live timing that'll be available, and some of them have a live stream, and certainly most of them have commentary as well. So yeah, it's going to be a fun thing to watch.
The international circuit, is that the old Grand Prix circuit that they would use?
It's not, but it's the Formula Ford Festival runs on the what is now called the national circuit. It's the club circuit, which is based on the old pit lane.
Yep.
And it runs as far as Beckett's, and then it does a hairpin right and comes down now what is now the Wellington Straight down to Brooklands.
Okay.
And then around what now Loughfield is not different. It's different to what it used to be, but it's the quote unquote short circuit. The international circuit is at the far end of the track, so it's a completely separate racetrack. You could actually run on the national and international circuits, I think, at the same time. I think that's the case. It's very close to here, but it's based at the far end of the racetrack, which is the south end of the racetrack on the Silverstone wing. So it goes up through Abbey Curve and that curve, and then it kind of rejoins the Grand Prix circuit at Chapel Curve, and then down the Hangar Straight, and then Stowe Corner, and the final corners onto the start finish line.
Okay, so instead of turning left onto Wellington, you essentially go straight and then right onto the Hangar Straight.
Effectively, yes.
Okay. Okay. Little international racing talk. So,
yes.
Jeremy Shaw.
Cool track, apparently.
Oh, yeah, it is. Jeremy Shaw, thanks for joining us. We'll have to have you on sooner rather than later. Hopefully, we'll have some good success stories from England.
Well, I'll drink to that, Jeremy. Thank you very much indeed for your interest. Happy days to everybody out there. And, try and tune in if you can. Thank you very much indeed.
Coming up next, our driver analyst Charlie Ante and IndyCar Radio's Nick Yeoman join us. We're going to be talking about an article that Paul Tracy shared earlier this week. Next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Over the past week, we've seen an article that Paul Tracy shared listing the 10 best drivers post-war who have never won the 500. This is written off of Auto Week by, let me scroll up, by J.P. Vetriano. It was issued May 4th. I'm kind of surprised it flew under the radar. So maybe in the kind of pest that I can be, I decided to get some of my favorite analysts on board to talk about this list and decipher it. This first half of the segment, we're going to talk about the list because it's interesting to say the least. Joining me, driver analyst Charlie Ante from the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network, Nick Yeoman, and Field of 33's Paul Dalby. I'm going to start with you, Paul, because as we know, you here are the foremost when it comes to the Indianapolis 500. Gave you a little bit of time to look at it. Before we talk about who's on the list, what did you think of it?
You know, it's one of those things you can debate this back and forth. You know, how do you define who are the greatest careers? Is this strictly looking at Indianapolis race versus a career? But certainly, when you had asked me, there were three drivers that came to my mind before I even got a chance to look at the article. And lo and behold, the three that I had were all, I think, in the top four or five. I think any time you talk about this list, at the top of that list has to be, whether you look at Indianapolis alone or a career, I think Michael Andretti has to be on top of that list. The other ones that came to my mind immediately were Dan Gurney and Sebastian Bourdais, both of whom have had remarkable careers, and but for a small bit of luck one way or the other, very well all three of those could and really should be Indianapolis 500 winners through the year. So I think that's a pretty good exhaustive list. There were some that I was surprised to see on there. I don't know that Paul Tracy, again, if you talk just about Indianapolis 500 wins and without getting into controversies, you know, I don't know that I would have put him on that list. But I guess I can't fault someone for being on that list. But I think they certainly hit all the ones that I would have thought of off the top of my head without digging real deep into the statistics.
And Nick, you've been basically in the front row of history over the past decade by broadcasting not only from pit road, but from turn two and turn one for the Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network and the IMS Radio Network for the Indianapolis 500. What are your thoughts on the list before we give that top 10?
Yeah, so I think it's a pretty interesting list. I don't have any really glaring issues because I just think, and I think Paul kind of touched on it, I think there's multiple ways to look at this. When I hear, okay, give me the 10 best drivers to have never won the Indianapolis 500, I immediately think of 500 history, the guys that tried and tried and tried, you know, put together some decent results, but, you know, ultimately came up short. I thought this list kind of looked at and said, okay, from an overall, you know, driving talent standpoint, who's accomplished more maybe outside of IndyCar racing and Indy 500, but did make a 500 appearance, except for one major name on this list. So I think there's multiple ways to look at this. This was kind of a different way, not maybe the way I would, but yeah, I don't have any glaring issues with the list.
And Charlie, you come from more of a road racing background, so I figured I'd get your eyes on it as well. Plus you are a driver analyst. What are your first thoughts going into this list?
Like the other two here, there's really not a whole lot to disagree with. I think it is a pretty solid list. I think the one thing that I would add is that, I think having Jimmy Vassar and Alex Zanardi are sort of the two, I don't want to say outliers, but they're the ones that are kind of like their IndyCar careers were really more of like Champ Car careers. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of their greatest moments were in the split. So they didn't really have the same opportunities that a lot of the names either pre-split or post-split have had. So that's sort of my take on it, I guess.
And I've got a couple of names on here on the list. We'll talk about that next segment, but this is kind of to decipher when we think what the top 10 list was. We'll have the article on our Facebook page and our Twitter account as well. You can check it out, debate for yourselves. But we're going to start off with number 10, Alex Zanardi. And Charlie, like you said, all of his success, came in the CART FedEx days. And he ran from 96 to the 98 season, rookie of the year, two championships. So 3 years, you know, he was great on ovals, but I think if Ganassi would have gone over and ran the 96 500, you know, instead of contesting the US 500, wouldn't have happened, but maybe we would have seen Alex go out and dominate that 500.
Yeah. I guess it's, you know, it's hard to say. You know, don't want to get too controversial, but I think that, you know, when the CART teams did go over to the IRL, they were very competitive from what I remember.
Yep.
So yeah, I think, you know, if, like you said, if Ganassi went over there to the Indy 500, yeah, Zanardi definitely would have been a front runner.
And gentlemen, feel free to interject at any point. Number nine, Paul, Jimmy Vassar, I had him on. We actually talked about that 2500 where he finished fourth and how he felt that he probably had a car as good as Montoya's. But I think Jimmy's best days were probably, yeah, 94, 95, 96.
Well, certainly Jimmy Vassar was able to take advantage of Chip Ganassi somehow always being at the front end of the best technology. You know, certainly 96 when Ganassi went to the Honda Reynard Firestone combination, they certainly took off then. But I think a lot of people tend to forget that Jimmy Vassar in 1995 was in a position to win that race fairly late. Mm-hmm. He was among the leaders through about 400 miles. On a very windy day, and I think he just kind of caught a gust of wind and ended up crashing in turn three late in that race. But I think a lot of people forget that he was very competitive in that 95 race. But I think that, you know, as we just touched upon with Zanardi, I think had Ganassi been at the Speedway in 96, obviously there's a lot of circumstances there in a 500-mile race that can go different ways, but it's hard to imagine, especially the way Jimmy Vassar had such a great year in CART that year, it's hard to imagine that he would not have been right up among the front runners, he and Alex Zanardi, right up at the front runners in 96, 97, 98, those golden era or golden years of Chip Ganassi Racing.
And Nick, after that, we've got the thrill from West Hill. Your counterpart over there on TV, Paul Tracy, in at number eight. That's one where I'm kind of like, maybe.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And I you can kind of sense a theme from this list. There's a lot of names that are, you know, their prime of racing and open wheel racing was right in the middle of the split where, I mean, ultimately, naturally, there's a lot of what ifs and Paul Tracy kind of fits in that. And you're right. I mean, he'll argue that he did win an Indianapolis 500 in 2002. But when you look at Tracy's career as a whole, certainly in American open wheel racing, very accomplished, did some incredible things, did some fantastic things in Champ Car after the split as well. But ultimately, I'm kind of with you in terms of pure Indy 500 results. It wasn't necessarily always there for Paul Tracy. But again, if you look at this from a different perspective, he is a very accomplished driving talent. And ultimately, in say the last 15, 20, 25 years, he certainly is a guy that deserves to be brought up.
And Charlie, I'm going to say the same thing about number seven, Tony Stewart.
Yeah, well, before I get into that too much, I think it's worth mentioning that the list is ranked by alphabetical last name. So, you know, rather than any sort of qualitative judgments that the author is making. I was surprised to learn that Tony Stewart never won the Indy 500.
Remember, guys, Charlie is a road racer, everybody. So just,
yeah,
don't bring out the torches and pitchforks just yet. Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, but was it 96? He was dominant early on. But the pop-off valve decided to fail, as was common back then in the mid-90s.
Yeah, you can certainly say Tony Stewart was an unfortunate victim of equipment issues. You know, you mentioned the pop-off valve issues in 96, where he inherited the pole position and really was strong early in that race. And then in 97 or 98, he also led quite a bit very early on, and as tend to happen to most drivers who drove for John Menard, their engine blew up in a fairly spectacular way. And I remember him being extremely vocal on the television broadcast. So something tells me that was 98, actually, because I think that was really the tipping point that his frustration really said, look, I think I'm done with this IndyCar thing. I'm going to go try my hand in NASCAR for a bit. But,
was that pre-save 11% off days?
Certainly being the 98. I'm sorry?
Was that pre-save 11% off days at Menards so that, you know, didn't have an excuse for the engine?
Exactly. For sure.
So for those who don't know, the big thing now at Menards is an 11% rebate. So you pay full price for everything, but you get a rebate back to spend at Menards. Our big thing at home here at the Scott family household is to save up for a tree because we've spent 2 weeks on a freaking floor. Anyway, Nick, Nigel Mansell in number six. And yeah, this is alphabetical order, but I mean, still, regardless, it's interesting to go, you know, backwards to frontwards, especially with number one.
Yeah, Mansell's kind of an interesting one on this list as well, a lot like Tony Stewart, where, you know, listen, the body of work in terms of Indy 500 attempts isn't necessarily there. He only ran the 500 twice in 93 and 94, but certainly an incredibly accomplished driver. I was actually kind of surprised to see that, okay, if this list was going to take the approach to put Nigel Mansell on the list, I was a little surprised to not see Jackie Stewart on the list, who, again, in the same category of Stewart and Mansell in the sense that the body of work isn't there, but did have two Indy 500 starts. And then certainly Jackie Stewart, a three-time Formula One world champion and 27-time Grand Prix winner. But Mansell, certainly an unbelievably accomplished driver. And certainly, you know, if you want to look at it, the Mansell mania thing, you know, certainly swept over the Midwest and anyone that was a racing fan. So it was a big deal, albeit in just two starts at the 500.
I'm going to toss this one back to Paul. Number five, Ted Horn. And what's interesting, I think, about Ted Horn is you take a look, he not only dominated pre-World War II, but he was pretty damn good post-World War II.
Yeah, it's hard to argue from a career standpoint. There aren't a whole lot of guys that aren't named Rick Mears throughout the 80s that have a better span of finishes than Ted Horn. He started 10 races, 9 of them he finished in the top 4. I mean, those are the types of things you expect from Rick Mears, Scott Dixon type drivers. Ted Horn, absolutely without a doubt, should have been an Indianapolis 500 winner. I mean, there's just no doubt about it, and it's just unfortunate circumstance year after year after year after year that kept him from victory lane. And it's a shame that he is, I don't want to say forgotten these days, but he certainly doesn't get the recognition of the, not just at Indianapolis. I mean, he was an incredible championship car driver throughout his entire career. He, perhaps more than anybody, I feel like more than anybody, perhaps as much as Michael Andretti, should have and deserved that win at Indianapolis and just never got that final break that he needed to crack through.
Up next on the list, Charlie, is probably one of the more known drivers. And doing my research, something that I did not know was the one driver that Jim Clark feared, and that's Dan Gurney.
Yeah, it's something that hopefully the other two have a better handle on that I'm interested in is because Dan Gurney was sort of an unusual position in motorsport history that he built his own cars for a long time. And I know he had two, or well, he ran his own Champ cars and Indy cars for a while. So can the other two, do they have any idea what his success was at the Speedway as a car owner?
That one, we're going to have to go to Paul on that one, because I think he would know a lot more than I know I would about that.
Well, in terms of actually as an owner, I don't know his actual legacy as an owner. I do know certainly the Gurney Eagles had a very good run. I think of Bobby Unser in 1968, I believe, was an Eagle that had won. I want to say was maybe Gordon Johncock in 1973.
Yeah, I was going to say Johncock, yeah.
Yeah.
Perhaps I should have said designer or constructor rather than owner.
Yeah, I mean, had to have been Bobby in 68. Johncock, didn't Bobby win another one in a Jorgensen Eagle?
75.
Thank you.
Yes. You're correct. 1975. Yes. Yep, the Jorgensen.
That's the thing about Gurney is I mean, it's of course, I mean, the results maybe weren't there all the time as a driver, but he was darn close as a driver, won it three times as an owner. And then when you just look at the technical accomplishments and the innovation that he brought to the sport, yeah, he is a no-brainer for a list like this.
And Nick, a driver.
And, you know, the interesting thing is I think that you know, for whatever reason, I don't think that he has had the – and this will probably be a controversial statement, so hopefully this I don't get flamed for it. I don't know that he has the long-lasting reputation in the United States as a driver that he would probably have if you ask somebody from Europe about Dan Gurney. Dan Gurney had an amazing Grand Prix career. And for whatever reason, I just don't feel that has historically translated to the United States, which is a real shame because Dan Gurney was an amazing talent on the global scale. And I think he's one of those guys whose career really has not gotten quite the U.S. recognition that it truly deserves because he never won an Indianapolis 500.
Well, Paul, I always considered you one of the more foremost bloggers in IndyCar, but geez, what an inflammatory statement. In all seriousness.
Well, I mean that to be respectful.
I know you do.
I think he deserves a lot more credit than he unfortunately gets in the United States.
No, and I don't disagree. I mean, I feel that he doesn't get the recognition that he deserves, especially with all the innovations that he made in racing, some of them that actually came to the mainstream in NASCAR back in the early 2000s with the quote-unquote Gurney flap.
Yeah.
So.
Yep, absolutely.
But if you ask those fans what a Gurney flap is, I'm not even going to go down that road. Nick, this is a driver that you've come to know over the past several years. Sebastian Bourdais makes the list.
Yeah, and a guy I know and respect a great deal as I think everyone inside the IndyCar paddock does. An interesting choice for the list from this list from a standpoint of in eight Indy 500 starts, he's only got two top tens and a best finish of seventh. So it's hard to say that Sebastian's had that really moment where we'll remember him in Indy 500 history of, man, that was the one that got away. He was so close. But when you look at the overall numbers and what he's accomplished in American open wheel racing, it is hard to argue. I mean, he is right up there on the wins list. Of course, a lot of people want to argue that, you know, it was cherry picking. It was easy pickings maybe during those Champ Car years when he dominated, but certainly the results stand for himself. And yeah, you ask anyone inside the paddock, there's nobody that they respect more than Sebastian Bourdais. And hey, how about the fact that he just landed another full-time ride to be back with AJ Foyt. So, yeah, that's a name that, again, a little surprising to me because the 500 results haven't been there in his career, but a guy that everyone respects.
Paul, number two, Tony Bettenhausen, the Tinley Park Express.
Yeah, this is one, I got to be honest, this is one that Tony Benton falls a little bit outside my wheelhouse, but he certainly had, through the late 50s, early 60s, was a guy that every driver feared and that you knew you had to beat. 1961, he was looking like he was on top of his game, and from everything I've read and understood, almost was a shoe-in for the pole position before he was fatally injured on the day before qualifications in that year, test-hopping another driver's car. But, you know, certainly an amazingly successful dirt car driver that just really won a lot of races through the late 50s, early 60s. And, you know, it's a shame that he never got to fulfill that legacy. And then, of course, the heartbreak of the family would just continue for decades later when his son Gary could have legitimately won in 1972 and then had another couple great chances later in the 80s and early 90s. And just a family of heartbreak all around. But Tony was definitely another guy that unfortunately doesn't probably get the recognition that he deserves.
And Charlie, this driver, I think, tops every list, alphabetical or not. Number one, found success as a team owner, but really couldn't find victory lane as a driver, Michael Andretti.
Yeah, I mean, the Andretti Chris is legendary, and I think it's most remarkable because Andretti is such a huge name in motorsport. I think anybody else, anybody who even doesn't follow racing would tie Andretti into motorsport, at least in the United States. And so the fact that the family has only, the entire family has only had one win there, is shocking, I think, even people that have followed the sport for a long time.
All right, with that in mind, we're going to take a quick break. Coming up next, Eric Brennan from Fan Racing Live is going to be joining me. We're going to talk some F4 FR Americas. And then after that, we're going to talk about who we think should be in the top 10 of the greatest post-war era drivers to never win an Indy 500 here on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
We'll have more of our roundtable on the 10 best post-war era drivers to never win the Indy 500 after we talk to our good friend from F4FR Americas, fanracing.live. It's Eric Brennan. Eric, I sent you the article as well, so you could participate. What did you think of that article?
I mean, you know, I kind of haven't gone over the history books on my end yet for a little while. I will tell you, you know, I break it down into two parts. You know, there's guys who competed at Indy on a regular basis, and that was their bread and butter for the most part. Then you have a lot of the guys who were in that article. You know, they mentioned Alexander Zanardi, Sebastian Bourdais, guys who were, you know, career, lifelong good IndyCar drivers. But, you know, there are some that stick out as people who were just always really good at Indy. Case in point, you know, every time that Ed Carpenter shows up, obviously it's his hometown. Now, a lot of people don't think, and no offense to Ed, of course, a lot of people don't put him in that category of like one of the best IndyCar drivers never to win the 500. But if you're looking at terms of people who have competed at Indy, I think that he is one of the best at that track, and he has put the most into that who has not yet captured the flag, and he was also close in 2018. So for me, it's kind of hard to compartmentalize. I laughed a little bit at Paul Tracy's response because, you know, I'm sure in his mind he may have the wind banner hanging up somewhere in his house that he obviously would have had to have had custom made. But, you know, it's, I don't know if it was that far off, but for me, I'll have to do a little more research myself. But Tracy and Bourdais overall, especially because, you know, I'm 30 years old, was born in 90, really didn't start watching open wheel racing until the late 90s, early 2000s. Those are the two that jump out at me at first. But I think there's certainly some more homework that has to be done to kind of form a final listing, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, and I tried to, I've got a list, you'll hear it a little bit later on. I've strayed away from the guys who are still competing, but yeah, if you're going to add those drivers who are still competing, I think you have to make a case for Ed Carpenter. You know, not mainly because he was a hot shoe in ovals in USAC and then went over to Indy, what is now Indy Lights, then the I think it was the Infinity Pro Series when he was running. You know, ran real well there and then ended up doing races with the then IRL. So we'll talk more about our choices, mine, Nick's, Paul's, and Charlie's. But first, we got to talk about the next 2 weekends. It's the Tour de Florida after we get done with the Tour de France over there. Oh, wait, different wheels, different motors. Regardless, 2 weeks in Florida, back-to-back races, two tracks that really apples to oranges. You have the rough surface of Sebring. The rough surface, I'm still trying to figure out why I can't get a refund on my shoes after I bought them 12 years ago. But anyway, and then you have Homestead Miami. So let's talk about what's going on in this weekend. What are the big storylines you guys are going to be looking at this weekend at fanracing.live?
Well, when you look at the Formula Regional America Series, I mean, the elephant in the room is Linus Lundqvist, and if he can continue his hot streak. And I will tell you, the preliminary entry list came out, and it looks as though, at least for FR, it's a bit of a light field. So far, we got 13 cars unofficially being entered. Probably the big thing that stands out to me is Kiffin Simpson, who has not had the season in F4 that I think he would have hoped for, also running for the same team in which point leader Hunter Yaney drives for. It looks as though they've elected to kind of push him up towards FR and maybe kind of use Sebring as an opportunity to see, you know, what they have in store and maybe just kind of give us a peek at what, you know, maybe next for that young driver. And, you know, when you look at his season as a whole, and you obviously want to, you know, it's open wheel racing. You want to compare your success and your performance to your teammates. And, you know, Hunter Yaney is having an incredible year. I mean, granted, the F4 calendar is filled with rookies, but, you know, we talked about it before on the show. You look at Hunter Yaney's racing resume prior, and, you know, it wasn't all that star-spangled. And then he climbs in the F4 car, and he starts knocking it out of the park. So when you compare, you know, him and Simpson, Simpson's had a lot of wrecks, many of which were not his own doing. Some mechanical failures as well. But it's cool to see Kiffin jump up. It's going to be with HMD Motorsports. So it'll be a teammate with David Malukas. But he's going to make up one of the new additions to, as I mentioned, it's going to be a 13-car field. But, I mean, Linus is running the table, so that's pretty much going to be it for FR to see if he could hold it down there. And I think in Formula 4, obviously, you know, if you take a look at the point standings, it's still Yaney, Tavella, Kohlbecker. But Jose Blanco is one of the few who not only ran at Sebring last year. Dylan Tavella is another driver who's up there in the standings, not a rookie in the season. But Blanco's got a win there. And he started to catch his stride right as we got to the break at Barber. I mean, as a matter of fact, his runs at Barber were very consistent. He had a problem in the middle race, but he walked out of there with a win under his belt. And I think he's starting to get into a bit of a rhythm, as is the entire Crosslink Kiwi Motorsports team. So I would pencil Blanco in as the guy to make sure that you have your eye on for the three races they're going to run in F4 this weekend, because this is his chance to put himself back into championship contention, especially if Yaney's going to have a hiccup of any sorts, which he hasn't shown. It might not even happen the way he's running this year.
And we know that this has been such a long break. It's unusual for a series to have almost a two-month break, but obviously because of COVID and all this rescheduling, it's become the norm in a lot of series. Do you think that a lot of these drivers, now I know that some of them have gone, they've done karting, they've done a lot of testing. Do you think some of these drivers might be just a little bit rusty going into this weekend at Sebring?
I would imagine so, and I would imagine it's hard not to be. I mean, some of these drivers do have affiliations with some local racing venue where they could take the actual car they race out to play and kind of break it down. I know that VRD had some form of testing not that long ago. Saw that making the rounds on social. But I don't know that anything could truly simulate what you're about to, the environment they're about to embark on. As you mentioned, Sebring is one of the toughest tracks. I always marvel the fact that IndyCar does the preseason testing there. Obviously, there's some parallels to some of the tracks that the circuit runs on throughout the year, but I've always known Sebring to be this really rough, physically demanding and tough layout. And you mentioned how worn out the surface is, and judging by some of the footage I've seen from last year, it lives up to its reputation with the open wheel series in F4 and FR. So I don't know what you can necessarily do to prepare for that. Obviously, making sure that you're physically fit, taking this time to keep yourself in the zone a little bit. And, you know, my fear, and this is just as brutally honest as I could be, we saw at the season opener, you know, how much of an impact a lack of track time could have in the racing product. And I really hope that we're not going to walk into a situation like what we had at Mid-Ohio. Granted, you know, we got 20, trying to check my notes here, for F4. I mentioned 13 FR cars. We still got 26 in Formula 4 that are signed up, and that number could flex by the time we roll into the racetrack on Friday. But I just hope that, you know, even though we're all ready and raring to go because we've been sitting on the sidelines for so long, that these drivers have been doing their homework and they are ready to go, and we don't end up seeing a repeat of the yellow fever we had at Mid-Ohio.
Well, and I know that also down in the southern Florida area, that's where Gustavo Yakubin has the F4 Academy. We know he has a couple of drivers on there. Are there any of those names on the F4 entry list?
Yeah, well, one of them, you know, VRD is really involved in that Velocity Racing Development, that is, and they do a lot to assure that the drivers that they're having in their teams, and it's also becoming a little bit of a backbone and additional push by some of the powerhouse teams that are in the series. They want to convince some of these drivers who may be coming up from karting or drivers who are even electing to start their racing career in F4, they want to push them towards a driver academy like the Academy, which they actually just released some of their testing dates and their schedules, and all that information is out there as well. I know that the Formula Americas Network put out a press release just to kind of funnel a little bit of interest because of how much that could benefit these young and in many cases inexperienced racers for moments like this. As far as some of the elements and avenues that the Academy may have had open, I believe that's who VRD was partnered with as far as getting some of their drivers ready to go, and maybe even a couple of other competitors who aren't necessarily VRD affiliated, but they still want to be prepared for this 2-week stretch that's coming up in Florida. And for any young racer who's listening or any parent or any, you know, I would recommend that they seriously look into these chances and opportunities, because the Academy, yes, there is a season or a schedule attached to it that's going to take place in February, but they lead up with multiple testing dates through November at a bunch of different racing circuits. And I think that it is that level of experience and the confidence that comes with it that will really get you off on the right foot. I think we could use the analogy that, you know, you could almost be starting on third base once 2021 rolls around if you do go down that road. And that's the reason why we recommend it, because it's obviously paid off for a guy like Hunter Yaney, who, rookie, leading the points, most wins on the season so far, that's the pathway he took to get where he's at now.
And, you know, I did want to lead into that next, but looking at the schedule right now, it almost reads like a Florida Pro Winter Series. So you actually start off December 2nd through 3rd at NOLA Motorsports Park in Louisiana. Beautiful facility, by the way. If you've never been there, I recommend it. And then the COTA, December 8th through the 9th in Austin, Texas. And then the rest of the schedule, you're in Homestead, either Homestead or Sebring. They have, it looks like, a long stretch. I don't know if this is a typo or not. Correct if I'm wrong. But January 2nd through the 28th at Sebring is all testing. And they have two race events, February 15th through the 16th at Sebring, and then 18th through the 19th at Homestead Miami Speedway.
Yeah, that's what I ended up seeing. And I already kind of blocked out the fact that I would probably end up being back in Florida for that week when that happens. I'm not exactly sure if me personally will be swinging out to the test dates, but, you know, it's track time. And I think even pre-COVID, track time for these cars in these circumstances, I mean, it's obviously hard to come by. I mean, we know of a couple of people who were able to take advantage of local options where you could get an open wheel race car out on there. But, you know, in a lot of cases, it's, you know, kart tracks, oval short tracks, dirt tracks, even where you're not going to have the availability to earn experience like this. And I mean, yeah, there are SCCA track days where you can go and sign up, but I think the feel and the environment of you know, truly having a test day where it could be your people, your engineers, and just your ability to go out and make mistakes with not a lot of people watching, they don't really present themselves that often. So seeing the amount of track time that the Academy has built up for everybody, I love it. I honestly, this would be my first time working with it as well. I didn't know that the racing portion was blocked into such a small time frame on the schedule. But it was fun to see that there is so much available practice time, because that's why we're harping it, you know, is get seat time, get acclimated with the car, get out there, be familiar with it. And once the season is ready to kick off, you know, your confidence level is as high as it could be. And then you can start, you know, gauging your performance of your competition. So I'll have more information on the Academy following this week and this round, because I'll be starting to engage in some discussion, because I kind of want to know some of the names of the people who, you know, may have already signed up for it, or who and what disciplines of motorsports they may be coming from. I know of a few unofficially, but I want to make sure that I could roll it out on the record when the opportunity allows. So that's, I'll definitely have more on that in the coming weeks.
Yeah, you're going to have a busy couple of weeks with, obviously, Sebring and Homestead back-to-back. And looking at the schedule on F4 and FR Americas, obviously, we're going to run the full Grand Prix circuit at Sebring, but it looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, the course that's going to be used at Homestead Miami is not the Roval course, but it's the FIA GT course that was initially run back in the late 90s.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I was looking for an answer on that, because I was looking forward to the potential of a Roval option, but you're right, it does appear that that's the route they're going to go. I do not have an official press packet yet, which I will say, the SCCA, they do a fantastic job, and it's not just the sanctioning body and Dan Hellman, but everybody from the official ladder, from Scott Goodyear and Brian Till, who's also a part of it this season, which it was great to see him before I heard his voice back on television again with the sports car stuff. Obviously, we know he was going through some stuff in the offseason. Just to see him back involved in motorsports in any facet just kind of, you know, lit up the room for me on a personal level. But they make sure that they dot every I, cross every T, and they release an entire detailed, usually it's an average of 9-page packet with track layout, where the caution lights are, blend line information. We have it for Sebring. I have not received it yet for Homestead. So I'm kind of nudging for that information along as well. And I will say the series has done a great job, even with the off time that they've had, not only putting out press releases on individual drivers to keep the PR folks at hard at work, not only to roll out the detailed, you know, television schedule that has been broken out. There's also some new, you know, on-demand options that fanracing.live is going to have up and running in the coming weeks. But they also make sure that the racers are informed, and that stems from COVID protocols to where you have to park your vehicle to you name it. And with the Sebring stuff, we got it all in hand for Homestead, track map included. I want to make sure that I got the final version of that, because as we know, everything seems to be changing this year. And I want to make sure that we're 100% certain that that's what we're going to see when we get there. But if that is the case, I'm excited because, you know, yeah, the Roval portion would provide a unique layout of it. And I think I said a couple weeks ago with you on here, I haven't seen that track in use, at least on a televised portion, since the Rolex sports cars were doing it back in the day. Mm-hmm. Now IMSA, of course. So I was hoping to see that in action, see how these drivers will be able to handle the banking in the front straightaway. But if not, I'm certain they'll still put on a great show.
One of the hardest crashes I saw in Grand Am Rolex history, outside of Joey Hand's tumble at Mid-Ohio, was Andy Lally backing it into the NASCAR 3-4 in that Magnus Porsche. I remember that distinctly for some reason. Another thing I want you to find out this weekend, I want you to pull Brian Till aside, find out what product he uses to keep that hair so luscious, because I've tried for years and he still hasn't told me.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've sent about 1,000 letters asking the same question, none of which have been returned yet. So, in fact, I'm not sure if I can get within 25 feet of them, but I will do my best.
25 feet? He's limited me to 50. Wow, I got to get your secrets.
always a pleasure, Jeremy.
I would say it's probably the Tony Kester effect. Eric Brennan, FanRacing.live. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you in a couple weeks when you come back from Florida.
You got it, and I'll be loaded with more info for you guys.
All right, so we're going to have the second half of our roundtable about the best post-war era drivers to never win the Indy 500 here on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Can't believe it took us a whole segment to realize that Charlie had his mute button on. Yeah, we're back with Paul Dalby.
Field. You can guess which one of us is the driver.
Yeah, exactly. It's not hard to tell that one, and two of us have to rely on engineers to get our sound to sound good. That's the funny part. Field of 33 is Paul Dalby, and our IndyCar insider, Pennzoil IndyCar Radio Network's Nick Yeoman, joins Charlie Ante and I. A couple segments ago, we talked about Auto Week's 10 best post-war IndyCar drivers who never won the 500. Charlie admitted that they have an alphabetical order, but I think it's kind of somewhat a 1 through 10. I'm going to start with Paul because he's probably got a couple names I have on here on my list that I've only got four drivers that I think I'd swap out for. But Paul, what do you have on your top 10 that necessarily wouldn't be in the Auto Week article?
Well, like I said, the first ones that came to mind were already there. Those being Michael Andretti, Dan Gurney, Sebastian Bourdais. I think if you look at Indianapolis 500 only, this will be one that may scratch some heads, but a guy who won a couple 500-mile races that probably came pretty damn close to winning it all at Indianapolis, and that's Scott Goodyear. I think he is vastly underrated. We saw what his first couple years at Indianapolis were mediocre in 1991, and then as soon as he got in equal equipment in 92, where he got into a Lola with a Chevrolet engine for Derek Walker's team, he really showed that guy's got some muscle. He knows how to drive on an oval. He knows how to drive fast, obviously losing just by the nose to Little Al, and then winning at Michigan later that year. Followed that up with another Michigan 500 win 2 years later for Kenny Bernstein's team. Had an unfortunate incident, I suppose we could say, in 95 with the pace car incident, and then kind of got hosed out of a shot at victory in 97 with USAC's incompetency. And so I think that's a guy that maybe a lot of people might overlook. The, you know, Goodyear for about 7 or 8 years there was really, really good at Indianapolis and legitimately could have won, you know, 1-2, possibly maybe even 3 races with a little luck on his side.
Well, let's be fair on that 595. That pace car was always slow for some reason coming out of the North Chute, and it caught out the eventual winner, Jacques Villeneuve.
It certainly did, and you know, you watched that video. That it seemed like the pace car was well into turn 4 when Goodyear was at the entering turn 3, and he just slammed the throttle, and he caught up on that pace car in a hurry. And after he passed it, Villeneuve stacked up a whole bunch of guys behind him that, you know, surprising they didn't have an incident in that. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. Rules are rules and history is history. But I think Scott Goodyear as a driver really deserves a little bit more credit and recognition for his years there in the 90s than he probably gets.
Who else you got on there?
Oh, boy. Who else? I would say the other one that I really thought of was who Nick mentioned earlier, and that's Jackie Stewart. Jackie Stewart came really close to winning the race as a rookie in 1966, and You know, one of the fun facts about the race is he's one of those guys when 1966 Graham Hill won the race as a rookie but didn't win Rookie of the Year. That went to Jackie Stewart, and that tells you how good his month of May was. You know, he had some other great runs, and certainly if you look at the body of work, as Nick alluded to earlier, you look at the body of his work as a three-time world champion, he's up there with the best of the best. And then, you know, never mind the safety advocate that he became after he stepped away, I guess while he was still in the cockpit, but certainly after he stepped away. Jackie Stewart is definitely one that I think a lot of people would put on their list of great drivers in the 500 that never won it.
All right, Charlie, let's talk about who you would add onto that top 10.
To be totally honest, I think that my Indy 500 knowledge pales in comparison to Nick and Paul. And I don't really know if I have anyone off the top of my head that I could think of.
All right, fair enough. Nick, what do you got?
Yeah, so, when you sent me the article, I had put together a list of about seven names that I thought probably deserved to have some consideration, and we brought up a couple of them, one of them being, you know, Jackie Stewart, and then I thought Paul touched on Scott Goodyear with those really three different times in the mid to late 90s where, if it wasn't for bad luck and just kind of fluke weird stuff happening, he probably deserved to be on there. If you want to go back to the quote-unquote glory days in the 50s and 60s, I think Lloyd Ruby deserves some considerations. 11 times he finished 11th or better. He was a guy often remembered for just a lot of bad luck that prevented him from winning the 500, maybe most notably in 1969 when it looked like he'd deny the Andretti family the only one that they have. He's an IMS Hall of Famer, 7 Champ Car wins, so Lloyd Ruby, I think, deserves some considerations. One of my personal favorites, Eddie Sachs, his Indy career started with some pretty incredible qualifying performances where there was a 5-year span where he started on the front row 4 different times, always seemed to have mechanical issues. He finished 2nd in 61, 3rd in 62, and is just remembered as being, you know, an unbelievably friendly and popular guy before he was tragically lost in a first lap accident in 64 with Dave McDonald. So there's a couple from the glory days, as they put it. You know, you mentioned Scott Goodyear in the 90s. Another one from the 80s and 90s that I always think of, Jeremy, is Roberto Guerrero.
Yeah.
I don't think he gets brought up enough. He burst onto the scene in 84, and all he did was finish, what, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 2nd in his first 4 Indy 500 starts, which is pretty remarkable. At the end of 87, obviously, he was seriously injured when he crashed in a test session and was in a coma for like 2.5 weeks. And I'm not sure it the Indy 500 statistics after that ever really came. But, I mean, you're lucky if you're going to find a driver that's going to have a 4-year stretch as good as Roberto Guerrero. So those are a couple names to consider. And then a couple guys that, you know, I think will probably fly under the radar. And I don't think you can make a consideration for the top 10, but I think deserve at least a little bit of love from the modern era of IndyCar racing. How about Vitor Mira? I mean, two finishes he finished 2nd at Indy twice, and 3 additional top 10s, a guy that was always in the hunt. And then another one, Jeremy, that a guy that I would love to see back at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway soon is Carlos Munoz, who was 2nd as a rookie in 2013. Nobody remembers that because, of course, Tony Kanaan won. He was 4th in 2015 watching Castro Neves and Ryan Hunter Ray duel. And then everyone also forgets this. If Alexander Rossi runs out of fuel, Carlos Munoz probably wins the 100th Indianapolis 500. So there's a bunch of names. Debate them as you'd like. But I think there's a lot of guys that can stake claim to being one of the best that never won an Indy.
I had 3 that you rattled off on my list. Obviously, Lloyd Ruby, Eddie Sachs, Scott Goodyear. And since Zanardi made that list, I'm going to even go stick my neck out and say Greg Moore. Think of how good he would have been at the 500, especially knowing now that he would have been the Penske driver in the now 3 car back in 2000. Here's another name that I'm surprised nobody mentioned, and that's Jim Crawford.
Sure.
You know, Jim Crawford, I think, was pretty good as well, especially in the late 80s there. You could even make the argument for Gary Bettenhausen. We talked about that, you know, 2nd place finish, the Bettenhausen curse. I don't even know if we can even say that in terms of the Andretti curse, but it was an interesting list. I don't think I for sure wouldn't have Paul Tracy on that list because handful of races. I think what, only one top 5 in that, if I'm right, Paul.
Paul Tracy?
Yeah.
Well, he had the one in 2002, but otherwise, yeah, he his luck really wasn't very good at Indianapolis. And, you know, unfortunately for Mr. Tracy, you can't say it's because of a lack of equipment. He took over the Rick Mears ride and had a great ride in 93. And then he's the forgotten guy on the 94 Mercedes team where, you know, Little Al and Emerson ran away with that race. Well, Paul Tracy had the same equipment. Unfortunately, he had a crash early in the month and just never recovered. But he had that, you know, by all accounts, he should have been able to walk away in the top three with the other two and just never got it going, unfortunately.
What if I also throw in Scott Brayton to that list?
I think Scott Brayton, unfortunately, Scott never really raced well at the 500. He had the start on the front row in 85, where he and Pancho Carter had the brand new Buick engines, and both of them were out by about lap 10. He had the pole in 95 and actually became a trivia question with Marco Andretti's performance this year. I believe he one of the few drivers to have started from pole and never led a lap in the race. You know, he had the amazing qualifying run in 96 that I consider myself fortunate to have been there to witness. And then, of course, everyone knows how that ended in tragedy just 6 days later. But Scott, as much as he was a beloved driver and sportsman of the league, I don't know that I would put him among my tops for actual race, you know, his ability, I don't want to say ability, that's the wrong term, his performances during the race. So I think I would hold off on putting Brayton on that list.
Nick?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I mean, certainly one of I think this list for a lot of them, it's filled with a lot of what ifs. You look at Greg Moore and you just look at the guys that we've lost over the years that, it's easy to forecast and wonder how many 500 wins they would have had. And Scott Brayton obviously got a lot more opportunities than a lot of guys had before he was tragically taken from us. But yeah, I'm with Paul in terms of top 10. I'm not sure I would put him there, but certainly a guy that is forgotten anytime soon.
I will say during
Jeremy, I will tell you one guy that's currently on that list, and I hope for his own sake that he is not on the list much longer. But as of right now, if we're talking about the list, I think you got to put Joseph Newgarden on that list.
And that was one of the names I was just going to say, as doing my research, a couple people did put Joseph Newgarden on that list. I don't think he's going to be on there much longer, to be honest with you. He's got a hell of a shot to win, especially with Penske. It's just a matter of getting that luck there, you know, at IMS.
Yeah,
yeah,
and Joseph
Nick alluded to the 2016 race where Munoz was chasing down Rossi, crossing on fumes. Well, not many people remember that Joseph Newgarden, then driving for Ed Carpenter, was hot on Munoz's trail. And those two were going to have a fairly decent battle coming to the checkers if Rossi would have he would have needed to go about three more turns. It was going to be between Munoz and Newgarden, though I don't think Newgarden was going to quite catch him, but he was certainly right there. Prime for the win if it would have shaken out that way.
Nick, you're saying?
I was going to say he's got 9 Indy 500 starts, but we got to remember he's only 28 years old, and obviously he's not going anywhere. I mean, Roger Penske's not going to let him walk out of the doors of that organization anytime soon. So, yeah, I mean, for the next decade, Joseph's going to get more opportunities. But I think it's fair, you know, if another 2, 3, 4 years go by, yeah, he is probably the next one on that list of asking, you know, what if, when's it going to happen? And we've crossed a lot of good ones off here in the last decade of Tony Kanaan and Will Power finally getting those Indy 500 wins. So, yeah, Joseph is probably logically the next one, but I wouldn't be panicking too much for young Newgarden.
As I say, when I do my homework on this list, a couple of the lists, I had a laugh at them. I actually put Danica Patrick on there. Granted, she has had a good run at Indy, but I don't think she had the near amount of races to consider herself best drivers to not win the Indy 500. Paul?
I think that's probably fair. I mean, Danica...
Wait, do I have to touch that one?
I figured you were the one that I wanted to comment on it, but go ahead, Nick.
I mean, listen,
look,
top 10?
Danica had some good runs. but
she did. I mean, there's what, 5 or 6 top 10 finishes.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, listen, top 10, no, but listen, if you made a list of the top 25, she might be on it, and I'll duck for all the bullets.
I don't disagree with that. That's a very valid statement. And Paul's still quiet.
I think that's fair. No, I think that's fair. I don't. She's not going to be in anyone's top 10 post. Well, she shouldn't be in anyone's top 10 post World War II. But I think she had more talent, and you know, there's some controversy with her, and she certainly ruffled some feathers and rubbed folks the wrong way. But when it came time to put the foot down, that girl could motor it around the speedway, and you know, you don't just typically accidentally finish third or fourth or fifth. You know, driving. I don't care who you're driving for. This is not a restrictor plate Daytona 500 where you can just roll around and you know, end up with a third or fourth place finish when you've been driving 25th all day. It takes talent to get into the top five and to finish at the Indianapolis 500. And, you know, she's done that on multiple occasions. So she has my respect. But I don't know, like Nick said, I think if you talk top 25, she might make that list, but top 10 is probably a bit of a stretch there.
Well, if you feel we have missed a driver or want to debate one of us on that list, you can tweet us at Inside Open Wheel, always open for suggestions. Before I let you guys go, it was announced earlier today, or earlier this week, I should say, that Scott McLaughlin looks like he's going to run the Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg. Here's the interesting hang-up. He's got to run the Bathurst 1000, fly Monday morning from Australia all the way over to Charlotte, get a new seat fitting, and run the simulator, run at St. Petersburg. That's going to be a whirlwind week. And Nick, as you know from having to go down there, I think, Paul, you've been down there as well, just even at the beginning of the season, with it being a street course, it's difficult as it is.
Well, the good news is it's a pretty short flight from Australia to Charlotte or wherever he's going. So yeah, no, that's brutal. It's brutal, but he's a world-class talent. And I think a lot of people are excited about it. I'm really excited about what this means for 2021, because I got a lot of questions of, okay, where does he fit in? Does this mean Team Penske's going to four cars, or does this mean someone needs to sweat a little bit? But yeah, no, he's an unbelievable talent, and by all accounts, a really nice guy. And yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be fun to watch him on the streets in St. Pete.
Paul?
I'd echo what Nick says. This guy has some real talent, and every time we've seen him, or I should say the times that we've seen him testing an IndyCar, he has been competitive right off the bat. I have no reason to suspect that, you know, I wouldn't say a top 10 or a top 5 is out of the question for Scott in his debut at St. Pete. I mean, it's going to take maybe a little luck, but we saw when Robert Wickens came in that these guys aren't afraid to, these guys that make their name internationally are not afraid to come into the IndyCar series and make a splash in their debut. And I have no reason to suspect that we won't see a very similar type effort from Scott McLaughlin at St. Pete here in a month or two.
All right, next week, Charlie, you and I've got to debate the Nashville courses. Nick, I have it in our chat. I'll send it to you, Paul. If you missed our Facebook page, Chris Neifel posted a design that he proposed to the city of Nashville when he was designing tracks for Champ Car back in 2007. It's a really interesting take. Charlie, you and I will debate that next week. And we'll talk about all the other news as well. So, Charlie, as always, thanks for joining us, bud.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nick, let's try not to get too pissed off at your Panthers. I mean, it's Cam Newton-less Panthers. Come on.
Well, they're 0-2 right now, and they're headed for 0-16. It's going to be a long year.
It could be worse. You could be the Chicago Bears and going for 2-14 right now after winning against two very bad teams. At least that's what I saw, so...
I just can't wait to see Nick Yeoman in the Cam Newton New Jersey or New England Patriots jersey here shortly.
Oh, that's really, going to be fun.
Right?
That's going to be fun. You know, here's the thing. I saw some tweets on Twitter that he's going through a football diet. So, Paul, I think you and I, at the end of the season, we should get him in a Cam Newton Patriots jersey that he needs to wear at next year's Firestone Grand Prix of St. Petersburg.
I think that's a great idea. I think there'd be a lot of a lot of folks, fans of the NTT IndyCar series that would love to see Nick Yeoman in a Cam Newton New England Patriots jersey.
You guys are breaking up. I can't hear you anymore. Sorry. Sorry, I got to go.
Book it.
Nobody wants to see that.
All right, Nick Yeoman, the Pennzoil IndyCar Network. We'll have you on after the Harvest Grand Prix because we're going to be talking about that one. That's going to be an interesting weekend, I think, coming up.
Sounds good, man. We're ready to mow down some crops at the corner of 16th and Georgetown. Looking forward to it.
And, Paul, don't mow down too many crops while you're out running, my friend.
Hey, I'll do what I can. Anytime you want me, I'm here for you, bud.
We'll get you on sooner rather than later. Hey, next week, we've got a packed show. So we're supposed to have Dylan Christie on this week. He's flying out to USF 2000 test. We'll talk about that next week. And a friend of a lot of us here on this roundtable, Paul Page, is going to be joining us. He's got a autobiography coming out next year, but pre-sale starts soon. We'll talk more about that next week and more on his illustrious career. So until then, I'm Jeremy Scott. Thanks for listening to Inside Open Wheel. We'll see you next week.